And welcome to another episode of Every Horror Movie on Netflix, the podcast where we watch, review, and discuss every horror movie on Netflix. I am Allison with an I and joined by my co-hosts, Allison with a Y.
Hey, hey, hey.
And Patrick.
Hello.
This week was my pick. I chose a 2022 film called Barbarian. Barbarian follows a young woman named Tess, played by Georgina Campbell, as she arrives at an Airbnb that she's rented in a rundown Detroit neighborhood, Detroit, only to find that a man named Keith, played by Bill Skarsgård, is already there and has rented it as well. As the two of them navigate an awkward situation, they'll learn more about each other and begin to discover dark secrets about their home away from home. So, like we talked about at the end of last week's episode, we have all three of us have already seen this film.
Mm-hmm. In the theater.
Yeah.
Theatrical release.
The two of you saw it in theater. I did not. And as is the case with so many movies, I had forgotten that I'd seen it until I read the synopsis and watched the trailer and was like, oh yeah, I saw this. But after doing that, I was really excited to watch it again because I remembered having some feelings about this movie. So, oh. Yeah. Yeah.
What kind of feelings?
Good feelings.
Okay.
Okay.
Yes, good feelings. Yeah. I had forgotten, I think, that Bill Skarsgård was in it, and what a nice surprise.
Mm.
Yeah, I was saying last night, it's nice to see him, like, playing a normal person who's a little weird in, like, normal ways, as opposed to just playing a fucking freak like he does in his two most iconic roles of his career so far, you know, Pennywise and Nosferatu.
Yeah, and not in, like, a big blockbuster movie, right? Like, this one definitely, I think, flew under the radar and then didn't because of how much people loved it. But it wasn't, like, didn't have a huge budget. It wasn't the summer film of 2022 or 23, you know? It was, like, just a horror movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's such a goddamn cutie, though.
He is. He is when he's not playing a total psychopath, yes.
Yeah.
And I mean, he's a good choice for this because, given the context that you do have for him and also the context of the situation, it's this guy seems okay, but maybe he's a freak. This guy could definitely be a freak.
Right. Okay. So I have, obviously watching this the second time, I had very solid memories of like what happened. So there weren't really any of the major plot points that were a surprise to me. But the first time I watched it, I remember the entire time being like, he's gonna do something. He's gonna do something. And being like, just like waiting for the turn just because of who Bill Skarsgård usually plays. And in that sense, brilliant casting.
Oh,
because
yeah.
Because just his presence alone gave me anxiety that I'm not sure an other actor would have given me in that role.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, agreed. Not just because of who Bill Skarsgård usually plays, but right, the whole premise of this movie is, for a woman, it's very, very scary. And I'm glad that they talked about it openly. Like, that was part of the script, was them talking about how, as a woman, this is a really freaky situation, and nobody was ignoring that fact.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, hell, I'd be freaked out if that happened to me.
Yeah, yeah. But he's such a good actor. I mean, I think that was one of my biggest takeaways from rewatching this movie. And I'm sure I thought it the first time I watched it too, but like, he just is a really, really good actor because he held that duality, you know, like it ended up being that his presence was not threatening and it was a red herring. Right. But he did do that for us. Like, he was just the right amount of, I don't know, because he wasn't even really creepy now looking back. But you assigned creepiness to him.
It's like, I mean, to kind of harken back to a recent episode we did, it's kind of like, does he have maybe the Norman Bates sort of effect?
Yeah.
Where it's just like, oh, here's this like kind of, he's a little awkward, but he's a cutie.
Yeah.
you know, but also could that mean that he's secretly like he's a bad dude? You know, I appreciate that setup that first time viewers get to experience with this movie.
Yeah, and it's a weird movie to talk about because it does sort of faint in the direction of being this movie about, you know, possibly a psycho fucking with a woman in her Airbnb. The marketing was more or less arranged in that direction, mm-hmm. and the first half hour or so of this is arranged in that direction. And then it pretty quickly becomes clear that's not what they're doing. And so we're kind of going to take it, the pre-spoiler room discussion today, up to the end of what we're going to call Act One. And it's weird to talk about because even the fact that he's not a psycho feels like a spoiler, but what the fuck else are we going to talk about here?
Right.
It's a movie that came out 2 or 3 years ago. If you like horror, you probably already saw it anyways, and we're going to preserve the rest of the spoilers, but, you know, I guess we spoiled it for you that Keith, Bill Skarsgård, is actually mostly a chill guy. He's a little weird. He's a little awkward. But he's not looking to, like, kill anybody.
But he's harmless.
Yeah. Yeah. He's essentially harmless.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's more than harmless. They end up, like... Okay, so I'm getting ahead of myself, but they end up having, like, a great connection.
I know.
He ends up being a really fucking cool dude.
I know. They have, like,
makes it even sadder.
Yeah. They literally have this really interesting connection where the person, she's, like, Tessa's character, she comes to Detroit to interview for a job, and it's for this documentarian who did a documentary about one of, like, the Detroit, like, music movements that Bill Skarsgård's character is, like, a part of.
Yeah.
And so there's, like, this really cool, that connection that they have. And, like, that's really sweet. And you're like, okay, this is a horror movie. Like, I know I can't get attached to these feelings, but this feels like a meet cute.
Yeah.
And, like, it gave me some cute little bubbly feels.
Same. Yeah.
Yeah, they have good chemistry.
Yeah.
And she does a good job of keeping her guard up. Like, I very much mm-hmm. was putting myself in her shoes, especially as somebody who has rented so many janky ass Airbnbs in Detroit.
Oh, no.
Just for the sheer fact of, like, I'm going to go throw my shit in the room. I'm going to lock the room. I'm going to go out and drink in Detroit. I'm going to Uber back and I'm going to crash in this room. Like, that's not totally what she was doing, but I was like, oh, I've done this so many times.
Mm-hmm.
But I think she did a great job of keeping her guard up as long as I would. And I'm a pretty skeptical person. And then he really did earn her trust, you know, mm-hmm. like, he didn't do anything that was overtly scary or threatening. Initially, she was kind of reading into a little bit of everything that he did, but he really mm-hmm. did earn her trust. And I thought that the chemistry that they had was so, so, so lovely.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Like, I was like, why doesn't this shit happen to me?
Why can't I run into a stranger who's also rented my Airbnb?
Who's also, we learn, not threatening at all and just really super cool.
Yeah.
I mean, here's where he's not cool. Is he's a white boy who plays jazz with his, like, I mean, it's fine, like, white boys can play jazz, that's fine. But he's hunting for, like, a new cheap house for them to take over in Brightmoor, which, yeah. I mean, we're all from Southeast Michigan, which regular listeners probably know, but we're all Detroit area. And we know the Brightmoor neighborhood. The writer-director, mm-hmm. Zach Kreger, as far as I know, doesn't have a connection to Detroit, but did do his research in that Brightmoor is a fairly run-down neighborhood in Detroit where a lot of hipsters like Keith, white hipsters, have come in and bought up cheap houses. I wouldn't be surprised if there are some Airbnbs in Brightmoor. So there's, I don't know, it's one of the many political issues, social issues that this movie kind of stirs the pot
about.
You know, there's some nods in the direction of themes about gentrification or short-term rentals, which is a political issue unto itself, honestly, at this point. I don't know if it has shit to say about it, really, but it raises the issue at least. And that was the one thing about Keith where I was like, okay, bro, you're hanging out in Brightmoor for a week to find, like, a rundown house in a depressed neighborhood to, you know, quote-unquote revitalize.
I don't know. I think one can have mixed feelings about that. I don't think it was trying to make, like, a massive statement. I think it was just acknowledging that this is, like, legitimately a thing.
Yeah.
That is especially true in Detroit, you know, mm-hmm. one thing that's very, you know, there has been a lot of incredible revitalization in Detroit, some of which is, you know, pure gentrification, been pushing out people who have been there for a long time, unfortunately. And but some of it is people going into neighborhoods that have been unoccupied largely for a really long time as well. And it's like, I think it brings up a really interesting question. What do you do with these places? You know,
yeah.
is there a good answer? Is there a good answer with what you do to it? And my thought is, I don't think there's a great answer, but I don't know. I can't speak for
you. Well, yeah, there is a great answer. There's you create a society that empowers the marginalized people who have lived there for a long time, were pushed into and ghettoized into that area, and make it so that they can actually live there and have a normal, comfortable existence.
Well, thank you for saying that.
A bigger solution than our country and society are really prepared to
exactly.
implement. But
I mean, like what are we going to realistically get people to do who like, you know, don't want to actually invest in communities without their own large economic gain? I appreciate the setting being in Detroit personally, because it is such an interesting issue with the neighborhoods in Detroit and how it can be so different from block to block.
Yeah.
And there are certain areas that people are like, oh yeah, you just like that place has been like largely abandoned.
Yeah. You don't go there.
For a long time. You don't go there.
Yeah.
It was funny. Just like only days before we watched, Patrick and I watched this. I was talking about Brightmore. We were talking about Brightmore with my mom, my parents. She had family who lived in Brightmore.
Like, so do I. So do I.
Oh, yeah. You did too. Mm-hmm. And so I had forgotten that was specifically the neighborhood that it was located in.
I have thoughts on this. I think that the fact that they included, they did a pan out a couple of times of this house that stood alone, and it was perfectly manicured, perfectly painted. It was a really, really cute little house. And then they zoomed out and all the houses around it were quite literally burned to the ground.
Burnt out.
And I think that that was such a political statement without like shoving it down our throats, right? So I don't think that those issues of gentrification and short-term rentals were ignored. I think the opposite. Mm-hmm. I think they were highlighted. Mm-hmm. But in a way that this movie isn't about how to build up neighborhoods in Detroit without, you know, running people out that have lived there. This movie is about neighborhoods going ignored, right, by the police.
Yeah.
Because of where they are, right? So we see a couple of times that the police are involved, and that's for part two. That's for act two. But I think that I think they did make a political statement without the movie being a political movie, right?
Yeah, I think just acknowledging it in a very real way that's not glorifying it is making a political statement.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly my thought.
I mean, I will agree to disagree on that. To me, it just felt like it was saying, here's a thing. And I'm like, okay, yes, I know that thing exists.
Well, you
I'm
know,
not sure what it was saying about it. You know, to me, that's not necessarily a statement so much as just depicting a thing.
Your average viewer doesn't know that, though.
Yeah. I wonder, right, because you especially are more connected to the stories and the history of that area. But somebody that's watching this movie from Denver, they don't know a lot about Detroit the same way I don't know a lot about Denver, you know, like.
Whoa, but it's not a Detroit movie. I don't think it's a movie about Detroit. Like it's not dealing with this in Detroit specifically as it is generally. Like this happens in a lot of communities other than Detroit. And again, I think it's depicting, but to me, and again, we had different perceptions here, but to me, it didn't really have anything to say about that any more than it has to say about a few other things that come up later that are big hot button social issues. But that's me.
No, that's fair. This is not a movie about Detroit. But really quickly, since this was made in 2022, this was after the incentive program period that Michigan had to make movies, right? Like this wasn't part of that.
Yeah, significantly after.
Okay.
But it wasn't really shot here.
It wasn't. It didn't seem like it didn't look like Detroit to me.
There was, from what I read, there was a little bit shot in Detroit, and the vast majority was shot in Bulgaria, because that's where you go to show a burnt out, disinvested neighborhood.
I mean, at least some of the shots of Brightmoor looked like, you can Google Brightmoor and that's what it looks like.
Oh, I mean, I'm not saying it was an inaccurate. It's just not Detroit is what I was trying to clarify. Like the street that you see is not in Detroit. Like the exterior of the street. I don't know what they actually did shoot in Detroit, but I was trying to find it. I was curious, just like, what's the Barbarian Street in Detroit, and it's not here.
Yeah, I mean, most of those buildings next to, and I really think it was exaggerated, like I was saying earlier, like that house stood out as pristine, whereas the mm-hmm. houses next to it were quite literally like burned down. Mm-hmm. I haven't not personally been on a street in Detroit where that was the case. I've also never been to Brightmoor, so.
It's rough.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you Google image search, Brightmoor, Detroit, then that's pretty much the pictures that you get. A lot of them.
There is a Barbara Street near or very, yeah, I forget if it's in Brightmoor or very close to it, but the street in the movie is called Barbary, and there is a Barbara, but not a Barbary Street in Brightmoor area, which I found funny.
So we've talked a lot about a couple of like interesting, powerful sort of hot button themes, like, you know, the male-female power dynamics between Tess and Keith. The, you know, gentrification issue. What we haven't talked about a lot are short-term rentals and sort of the ethics around that, the controversy around that, and how that topic is sort of portrayed in this movie. I mentioned that I've rented, I mean, I use Airbnb a lot. I am grateful that it exists. I'm also aware of the huge issues that it causes with the real estate market for local people. I think that it was a good idea in theory that got abused, like many things. Mm-hmm. What did you guys think this movie had to say about that?
Well, first, I just want to acknowledge that you can't spell barbarian without Airbnb.
Oh.
And vice versa, which may or may not have been intentional, but it's kind of funny.
That is funny.
That is such an astute point. I just have to say, Patrick.
I don't think I actually realized that until I did the Allison with an I thing and was looking at Reddit after I watched the movie and was reading through other people's thoughts. But somebody pointed that out. So hats off to whatever Redditor said that.
I love it.
But yeah, I don't know. To me, it's another thing where the movie kind of like, again, faints in the direction of having something to say, but doesn't have a lot to say. To me, it has a little more to say about that than it does about, say, gentrification or what we were just discussing. I liked a little later in the movie, we learn a bit more about the ownership of the building and the extremely crass attitude with which this building has been used.
Treated, and yeah.
Mm-hmm. That was funny and felt a bit more political, a bit more of a statement, and amusingly satirical to me in a way that it has a tone that the rest of the movie really doesn't. But again, that's kind of getting into a character that we're going to talk about in the spoiler room. And I think we'll have a lot of fun with that character.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's willing to say that this is a thing that happens and that it's not a good thing, but there's not a lot more depth to it beyond that. To me, like the movie in general, to me, is just kind of throwing a bunch of social issues into a pot and being like, here, look at these. These will get you fired up, won't they?
Hmm. So it felt, did it feel like contrived to you?
Contrived. I don't know if it felt contrived so much as there was like a lack of follow through to me. The movie is willing to introduce ideas and acknowledge social issues, but to me it just didn't have a lot to say other than like, this is probably a bad practice. Like there wasn't a lot of, it's shallow. To me it was shallow. I don't know if I would say contrived, but shallow is the word.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about you? Why? You're making some faces.
I just don't know why you would make a horror movie to like go in depth about the evils of short-term rentals. I think you can acknowledge that something exists. It can be part of your story. You can not condone it. And I think that's enough, I guess, for me. It was very much of, I think, the time that it was made and acknowledging these things. And yeah, I just don't... It was pretty clear to me that it was like, yeah, it's kind of fucked up to, you know, own an entire house just to use it as a short-term rental. Like, that message came across pretty clear to me. So,
yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I'm saying. It's just like, but to me, that's just like kind of a simple message and didn't, you know, rock my world or anything.
Right. I'm not saying it rocked my world. I think it's, I don't know. It was like nice to have that acknowledged in a film for once.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah. It just, this shit doesn't get talked about a lot outside of, I feel like, the kind of circles that we're in.
Yeah.
And so a lot of these issues of gentrification, these issues of short-term rentals, it's frankly, for me, it's refreshing to just have it acknowledged in something that has been like kind of successful.
I agree. Yeah. Like, this isn't a documentary about that. And I will say, I have to a little bit disagree with you, Patrick, but I can't totally say why, because we're going to talk about it in the spoiler room, which we're in Act Two. But I do think that the short-term rental, as it relates to housing disparity, unethical practice, does get a sort of, I don't know, like a proper fuck you in Act Two. Again, we can't talk about it yet, but and not the whole rental market as a whole, but the types of people that practice this.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Right? I'm trying to say without saying too much.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I just think there's some interesting stuff in here around, you know, and I mean, the gentrification thing with Keith, the Keith character trying to find this, you know, cheap house for him and his friends in Brightmoor. There's a lot of interesting stuff in this movie about housing. Like, also there's, I mean, this is spoiler room stuff too, but there's, it sort of gestures in the direction of talking about Detroit's history of white flight at a certain point as well, which is also pretty interesting. But that to me was also not really developed. And I guess more, it's not so much the, in my view, failure to kind of craft a coherent statement on one of these ideas. It's not that bothers me so much as the number of different ideas that it kind of throws at you and then doesn't do much with. And there's another very big one that comes up right at the beginning of the second act that kind of bothered me too, that it was a big plot point that was just kind of throw away, a hot button social issue turned into a throwaway plot point, but we'll get to that. I don't know. It was more kind of the volume of those topics that it kept hitting on, more so than the lack of follow through, I guess, for me, that bothered me.
But don't those things relate to one another, especially when you're talking about the history of Detroit and the present, like the present time in Detroit, gentrification, short-term rentals, and the history of white flight in Detroit leading to those problems as well. Mm-hmm. So to me, it made sense. It was all part of the story of a neighborhood and how a neighborhood got to be this way.
I agree. Yeah.
But it doesn't really get into how it became that way. And then the central, you know, kind of villain of the movie doesn't really have anything to do with that either. I don't know. It's all just a lot of like misdirection, bobbing and weaving to me. I feel like I'm like reading a paper, except you've given me like, you know, a couple sentences from each page of your paper on gentrification in Detroit. Zach Kreger's paper on gentrification in Detroit, or gentrification in general, or housing in like, I don't know. I don't know what he was doing with this. Like, I walk away from this and I go, I don't know what the point was, because also a lot of it is just kind of like weird fucked up stuff that ends up happening in the second and third acts. And there's a lot I like. I just don't really know what the overall intention was when it's over.
Well, if we can switch gears a little bit. You did put a fun fact here in the show kind of synopsis that I want. I didn't know. If I may, read it.
Yeah, go for it.
The word barbarian comes from the ancient Greeks, who thought that non-Greek speaking people's language sounded like the gibberish words bar-bar. I didn't know that.
I didn't either. And then Allison, who's a bit of a Latin scholar, said that they had heard a completely different. I mean, you like studied fucking Latin, which not many people our age can say. But you've heard a different origin for this word. This was just what I learned from first Reddit and then corroborated by Wikipedia. But apparently there are differing opinions on where the term barbarian came from.
Let's hear it. Why? I need to know.
So I took 4 years of Latin in high school. Very cool. And I very
like I said, Latin scholar.
I saved Latin. What have you ever done? Sorry, I had to say that quote.
I was the last ever 4-year Latin student to graduate from my high school.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, which, dumb fact. But anyways, okay. So I learned that barbarian came from the Latin word barba, which is the Latin word for beard, also where barber comes from.
Whoa.
And barbarians were considered, quote, wild men. So they had long kind of wild beards. And so they were named barbarians after their long beards. Latin, the Latin word barba for beard.
Cool. So
that's what I learned.
Yeah.
Another thing you wrote here, Patrick, that was cool is the Western Roman Empire fell to barbarians in the year 476, the same number as the house in the film. What a fun little Easter egg.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and the interesting thing, too, though, there's another big connection with this barbar thing, which is spoiler room territory. We'll touch on that later. But Zach Cregger has said, and I don't know, this honestly makes so much sense to me, but he said he started writing this movie with this premise of, you know, going to an Airbnb and somebody being there who's not supposed to be there, and specifically a woman walking into an Airbnb and finding a man there. And then he just wanted to play out that scene for 30 minutes and kind of like see where it went. And then he just got frustrated with the whole thing because he didn't know where to go next. And he gave it a placeholder title of barbarian just because he liked the word. Like, he has not, as far as I know, nodded to any of these historical references. He's just like, I like the word barbarian.
That's so funny. And then, yeah.
And then he just ditched the project, I think, for a little bit and eventually came back to it with wild twists, which I mean makes so much sense. It's like, yeah, it feels like you wrote a long ass scene, a long ass first act, didn't know what to do, and then went in like an insanely different direction, which is part of the fun or the frustration of the movie, depending on your reaction. But I don't know, just an interesting historical details about that word, and also an interesting like kind of just rejection of any of that theory from the guy who wrote it.
Yeah.
Also, this guy is from The Whitest Kids You Know. Zach Cregger is a member of The Whitest Kids You Know. So interesting trajectory there, I guess, a la our boy Jordan Peele.
Oh, I don't know anything about The Whitest Kids You Know, but you had me at Jordan Peele.
Sketch comedy troupe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, cool.
Yeah, so got his start in comedy and has segued into horror.
Horror, yeah. Zach Cregger has that upcoming movie Weapons, right?
Yes.
That's coming out this summer.
Yes.
I'm looking forward to that movie, even though it's kids and kids creep me out.
I am very curious, too. I mean, kids in horror creep me out. Yeah. I am very curious. I mean, kids in general creep me out.
Yeah, same.
Horror or not. Same. But no, the movie looks very good, even though, you know, I mean, we haven't reviewed Barbarian yet. I'm a little mixed on Barbarian. But yeah, Weapons looks very intriguing. Awesome cast, too.
I actually haven't heard of that at all.
I couldn't really even tell you what the premise is based on the trailer, which I love, honestly.
Yeah, something
like,
happens.
I love it when you don't give me your whole story in your trailer.
Something happens to a whole town of kids and they become bad. They go bad. Yeah.
Nice.
We got Josh Brolin, I think, right?
I think so.
Julia Garner.
Yeah, Julia Garner. She's the big draw for me. I love her.
Yeah, Josh Brolin, Brian Tyree Henry, who I like, Benedict Wong, who I fucking love. June Diane Raphael is in it. That's extremely exciting. And Alden Ehrenreich, who I like very much, except when he's playing Han Solo. But yeah, very excited to see what this guy does next. I also got to give credit, you know, I was just saying the marketing for Weapons, I have to give credit to, like, I don't really know what I'm getting into with that movie. And also, after rewatching Barbarian this time, I went back and rewatched the trailer as well because I was like, I'm pretty sure this trailer did a hell of a job not spoiling this movie. And boy, does it. Like, it doesn't really show anything beyond Act 1. A pivotal character who shows up in Act 2 is seen for, like, the briefest glimpse in the trailer. But overall, phenomenal marketing and also like extremely disorienting marketing because you think you're getting into one thing and you're getting into something else entirely when you see the movie, which serves the movie very well because the first half hour seems like a certain thing and then it's not. So good job to the marketing team on Barbarian.
Yeah. I wouldn't have known that this was his first solo writing and directing project.
No, it's very assured. It feels very confident. It's stylish. it's very well
topical,
done. Very well directed.
Yeah, well cast, well acted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I feel like we should review it. I'm kind of dying to know where you guys stand on this.
Yeah, and we have to quit talking around. We can bleep his name out. That'll be funny.
Are we going to be in the spoiler basement yet again?
Oh, spoiler, yeah. Spoiler tunnels?
The tunnels, the spoiler tunnels.
The ample square footage of the spoiler basement.
The very ample square footage. Oh my gosh. Well, but I guess before we review and go to the spoiler tunnels, Allison with the Y, do you want to talk about our social media presence?
Oh, yeah. So you can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, YouTube at Amoncast, EHMONCAST. And you can find us on TikTok at Amon Podcast. You can also join our Discord community that you can find in the show notes, where we love to discuss the horror that we've been watching on the podcast and the horror and horrors of life that people have been experiencing outside of the podcast.
The horrors that persist.
And boy, are there many.
We always say that, but then we don't really do that, which is a good thing, really.
And feel free to leave a review anywhere that you have listened to this podcast. We love to hear about what you think, but only if it's good. So leave us a good glowing review. We appreciate it.
We need it. We need that review average to be pushed up to 4.5 stars instead of 4.4.
Oh, yeah.
It's been 4.4 for far too long.
All right, guys. Well, without further ado, we're going to review this movie. Allison with a Y, would you view it, cue it, or screw Barbarian?
You know what? I didn't think before I rewatched this that I would give it a view it, but I'm giving it a view it. I really liked it the first time I saw it. And then over time, I was like questioning myself. Like, did I really like that movie? And then, yeah, by the end of the second watch, I was like, yeah, I like this movie. I recommend it. I think it's a horror movie that a lot of horror fans would really like. It has it all. It's got a lot of suspense. It's got some great levity in there to break the tension. It's got some gore. It's got some batshit insane plot points. And I thought it was a good time. A little stressful, but a good time. So yeah, I would give it a view it. Patrick, what are you going to rate Barbarian?
I'll give it a cue it. As I said, I think it is well directed, well staged. My main issues are with the screenplay. I almost admire the audacity of the fact that this guy had a certain concept in mind. He got bogged down and kind of didn't know where to take it. And so he just went in a wildly different direction for the latter two-thirds of the movie. It is jarring to me in a way that is confusing. Like, I almost like the left turn, but I'm also so disoriented by it that I don't know if I actually like it. And obviously I have some strong thoughts, as I said earlier, about the way it just kind of stirs the pot on a lot of social issues, and in my opinion doesn't do anything with that, but certainly better than a lot of the shit that's out there. Well performed, well directed, and I am, like I said, already quite curious to see Weapons and what this guy does next, because I think this shows a ton of promise. It's just a little messy for me both times I've seen it. Allison with an I, how about you?
Oh my God, this is such a hard, hardcore, emphatic view it for me. Yes. I loved it. I fucking loved this movie. Patrick, you messed up our ratio. We had so many three-way view its, cue its, and screw its, but it had to end at some point.
Those are boring, though.
They are. I'm actually kind of surprised at your rating, and you make a great case for it, but I had a totally different takeaway from this movie. I mm-hmm. thought that, especially the female character, I thought she was written with a lot of respect. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think I love the acting. I loved the absolute twist or turn. Like we said, I don't know if we said offline, but it feels like two different movies. But then it comes together in a really brilliant way for me. Like I think I said on the last episode, if I had budget to make a movie, I wouldn't make the one that we watched last time. But this is totally the kind of story that I wanted to watch, you know, mm-hmm. especially part two, especially act two. It gets so unhinged.
Yes.
Yeah, this is an emphatic, absolute view it. I'm going to spread the word, re-spread the word. I'm sure I loved it the first time too. My memory is sucky, but yeah, I mean, this has gone on my short list of favorite horror movies, I think.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I had hoped to react better to it this time around, or to catch things that I missed the first time around. And mostly it was just remembering things that I had forgotten from the first time. I don't know. It hit about the same on the second viewing as the first for me.
Well, I'm glad
you guys loved it like most people did.
Yeah. Anyway, let's go to the spoiler tunnels and get into this wacky second part of the story. We'll see you there. All right, guys, we are back. We are in this spoiler tunnel of dungeon maze-like corridors in the basement of this Airbnb in Detroit, where fucking stupidly our characters have investigated something strange in the basement. So dumb. Don't do that.
No.
This is where I was like, this is where I would stop. I mean, I said earlier that I related to Tess and like the guard she kept up with Keith. And this is where I was like, nope, you lost me.
Mm-hmm. Well, although I will say for the most part, this is another thing I will give Zach Kreger credit for, is Tess is pretty fucking smart.
Mm-hmm.
When things go wrong, it's, you know, just kind of common mistakes. You know, her phone happens to be upstairs or whatever. Mm-hmm. She gets back downstairs with the phone eventually. Like most of those really obvious things that, you know, everybody complains about in horror movies where it's like, why the fuck would you do that?
Yeah.
For the most part, Tess makes some pretty smart calls here, and when she finds something weird, usually she turns the fuck around and says nope, and then winds up back in the situation for fairly natural reasons.
Yeah,
she
only went to the basement to find toilet paper, and then she got locked in the basement mm-hmm. and found some weird things, found the tunnel system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a fucking labyrinth underneath this house, essentially. Like, these tunnels have to go on for blocks.
Oh my god.
At least a square block, you would have to guess, right?
And I want to highlight what you just said, Patrick. Like, she really did keep her wits about her. Like, she was in no way like in flight mode or freeze mode. Like, she was mm-hmm. fighting to get out of there, and she was smart. You know, I'd like to think mm-hmm. if I were mm-hmm. in that position, and we all say that, and we truly don't know what our, you know, nervous system would do if we were stuck in a, you know, high stress situation like that. I would like to think I would have done what Tess did for the most part, because mm-hmm. she had good instincts.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's so much of this where he writes her into a corner in very smart ways, you know, ways that don't feel contrived, ways that feel natural. Mm-hmm. Like when Keith comes back after she's found all this weird shit in the basement, she's trying to tell him, the basement's fucked up, don't go down there. And he's being a bro, you know, like, oh, it can't be that
he's
bad.
He's being
like,
such a dude about it.
It's fine. Like, let me just go check it out. And I loved that the script had her stick to her guns and be like, no, I'm not. And the only reason she finally goes back down is because his voice disappears. He's no longer talking to her. And she's like, fuck, what mm-hmm. happened to him? And it's like, okay, like, again, supernatural, super believable ways to get this character written into multiple tight spots. Huge props to Kreger for that.
And her acting.
Kreger, it sounds like a douche bro, like nickname for a guy named Kreger. Hey, Kreger!
It does. And her acting, like, she looked genuinely terrified, you know, like when she was calling for Keith. I was watching the movie being like, this is happening to somebody right now. This is really happening. Like, she just did a phenomenal job portraying that just absolute terror of, I don't really know this person, but I feel responsible for them and I like them. And
she's not just going to abandon him.
Right.
She's great in general.
Oh,
like
we've
given Skarsgård a lot of flowers, but mm-hmm. Let's give her flowers because she is the lead and I think she kills it.
Yeah.
Great casting, great performance. But yeah, there's a bunch of tunnels, weird shit in the basement. There's a camera. There's a fucked up bed that looks like somebody shat all over it, bled on it maybe. There's a bucket that someone was clearly pissing and shitting in.
There were dog kennels the deeper she got.
Yeah.
And then a fucking deformed naked woman runs out of nowhere and bashes the shit out of Keith's head.
Just when Tess has finally found him again in the bowels of this basement. Yep. Yeah, this crazy, I don't know. What is she? We learn later that she's an inbred, like, reclusive. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Her, I mean, she's never left the basement. Oh, I guess she has, but she has never lived.
She comes out at night.
She only comes out at night.
She's not been civilized.
She mostly comes out at night. Mostly.
Amazing callback. She's not been civilized, that's for sure. She's naked and she's got some big old titties.
Big old titties.
that she likes to nurse with. Mm-hmm. Turns out.
Yeah, there's like a whole like room with just a nursing instructional video from like what the fucking 80s? 70s or 80s on repeat.
Yeah.
That is presumably the only media she's ever watched in her entire life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a fucked up scene down there. It's but before not good. We learn too much more about her, we meet Justin Long.
Yep, just cut to
hard cut.
Justin Long in his little red convertible in LA.
Driving down PCH, driving down Highway 1.
Yep. And he finds out that his career's over. He's
been Me Too'd.
Yeah, he gets Me Too'd.
And the bad news just keeps coming for him. Like, he's on his cell phone in his convertible looking like he couldn't get higher in life if he wanted to.
Yes.
And it's just like one sentence after another that is in this conversation on the cell phone gets worse and worse and worse. It's like, hey, we're dropping you from this project. There's an article coming out. You're going to need a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And you're fucked.
And the allegation is rape.
And the allegation is specifically that you raped her. Yeah.
Because it starts off with his lawyer or handler or whatever is like, someone said you were sexually aggressive on the set.
Right.
And then it later, the euphemism drops away and it's like, yeah, it's a rape allegation.
Yeah. And you're probably asking as the audience right now, if you're still listening and you haven't seen the film, why is there just a cut to Justin Long in LA just getting the worst news of his life? Well, guess who owns the house in Detroit and needs to liquidate so he can get some money for his lawyers?
Investment property.
That's right. Investment property.
Investment property.
That he has completely neglected and doesn't give a shit about the renters, the house, none of it, as was briefly portrayed in Act One, where Tess first realizes that this Airbnb has been double booked and she calls the management company. Of course, doesn't get an answer because now we learn that nobody gives a shit about anybody over there.
Yeah.
And leaves a message and they never call her back. And like now we have a face to who she's calling, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's this fucking guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this fucking guy is the way to describe him. This Whoa. Character is written and performed to be the biggest fucking douchebag you've ever seen. To a hilarious degree.
And it's so weird because, like, other than this movie, I pretty much have good associations with Justin Long. He's often played goofy characters. So for him to just, like, straight up play this absolute piece of garbage who has no self-awareness whatsoever was very interesting.
That is so funny that you say that, because before you just said that about him, I was going to say Justin Long is to sleazy douchebag characters as Bill Skarsgård is to creepy ass monstrous characters. My impression
what
of Justin...
What have you seen him in where he's a sleazy douchebag?
So yeah, I actually agree with that. I think of him more as a little bit of a scummy guy. And I literally can't think of what or why. I don't feel like I've seen a ton of Justin Long movies necessarily, but I don't know why I associate...
I got
it,
one.
It's just his stupid little face. He just looks
a little
weaselly.
Punchable little stupid face.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I reviewed... I actually reviewed Tusk for the podcast.
Oh, right.
Ago, and he plays the same fucking scummy garbage person sleazebag.
Yes.
And you know what? Even before that, I thought that about Justin Long. I think he is a scummy little – he plays a perfect scummy little sleazebag, dirtbag, garbage person character. So I was like, as soon as I saw his face, I'm like, fuck that guy.
I think it's just prejudiced by perhaps the limited numbers of movies that we've seen him in. Yeah. I believe that he also like can play a decent person well, and that he is a decent person just as a human being. But he is real good at playing these nasty little self-assured little weasels.
Wow. So I guess funny. I just have not seen those roles.
Yeah, what movies have you seen him in that made him likable?
I mean, like, the one that I can think that sticks out the most is Dodgeball. Okay. Like, he's like the young guy that he constantly gets beat up. Like, you feel really bad for him. And also, he played a recurring character in New Girl that was, like, very goofy, very sweet, very like male Zoe Deschanel.
Oh, I don't think I made it that far in New Girl.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I haven't either. But that's so funny that our interpretations of him are just completely different.
So funny. Wow.
It's almost like he's a versatile actor. And Allison's seen him in some things where he plays good guys. And we've seen him in a couple of things where he plays fucking nasty little weasels. There's a line in this where, and I mean, I'm not going to use the specific slur on the podcast, but he uses the F slur to greet his friend. Ugh. Like, picks up the phone and it's just, "What's up?" And the camera like pushes into him and the delivery is so aggressive, and it comes at a point where it's like, this guy has already been shown to be such a fucking douchebag, and it's just, to me, was this hilarious like little cherry on top of the shit sundae that they built, showing you like just what an asshole this guy is. And I cackled. It was perfectly staged.
It really was, because he had just gotten off the phone after getting bad news after bad news after bad news. Mm-hmm. And then he picks up the phone and it's his
right.
It's his fucking dude bro buddy. And the transition to like, "What's up, F slur?" And we learn just a clip later that he's gonna meet up with his friend at a bar in Detroit. He's like one of his Detroit friends. But yeah, dude, I was just, it was perfectly placed.
Yeah.
Yeah, they nicely set up this character to be, as the audience, you just don't have any empathy for him.
Absolutely not.
100% hateable.
The most hateable. And that scene where he meets up with his friend in Detroit and his friend's like, "Hey, man, I got to ask, you know, like, what really happened? I'm here. Give me your version of things." And he thinks that he's like, he genuinely, like Patrick earlier, when you said he has no self-awareness, he has zero self-awareness. Like, he's hearing himself say, I mean, she did say no at first, and then, you know, like, she warmed up to it, and, like, he was like, did she, you know, she said no, and he's like, yeah, I mean, she did say no at first, but then she warmed up to it, man, and she was, like, into it, you know? And you're just like, you are fucking disgusting. I don't care what happens to you, and I hope it's, actually, I hope it's bad.
Yeah. Which was nice after, like, you know, we had been introduced to these two characters at the beginning of the film who we did like.
Yeah.
You know, who you do grow to like. You know, you root for it, that you see one of them brutally murdered. And it's just like, well, I don't want to go through that again. So thank you to the writer of this, writer and director, for giving us
some cannon fodder.
Yeah, giving us an absolute shit ass to hate on.
Yeah.
And this is what I was referencing in the first part of the podcast before we came down to Spoiler Room, was I think that they attached, right, the Airbnb owner to being this scumbag who lacks ethics and morals. And so they're saying something about being an Airbnb owner, owning a whole house in a neighborhood where people can't afford homes that live there, to this scumbag. Like, I just think that that was the message, right? Like, Patrick, you said a couple of times that you didn't feel like they did anything with it, but I feel like they did just the right thing with it without making this movie about the ethical practices of Airbnb.
Yeah, I mean, I still disagree on that, but, you know, we've trod that ground already. Yeah. But if the F slur is the cherry on top of the picture of him being an asshole, the movie then slides you a whole additional sundae when he starts exploring the Airbnb and discovers the tunnels. Oh my God. And I mean, this is, I mean, just hilarious. I cackled in the theater. I don't know if I cackled when I saw it the second time, but it's just funny.
Yeah.
He finds these nasty-ass dungeon-like rooms with all this gross shit in them that we've described already, and he goes to grab a tape measure to figure out how much money he can make off the additional square footage in his house.
I laughed out loud.
It was so funny.
It's really funny.
That was one of my biggest memories from seeing it in the theaters was that scene. Because I remember watching that and being like, this is absolutely hilarious.
And it like went on a little bit too long, you know, like like he's like, oh shit, it goes all the way back there. And like it was funny and then it got funnier to me. And especially like obviously the juxtaposition between his reaction to seeing this room with the skeevy bed and the camera facing it and the bucket. He like just moves the bed because he's trying to get and Tess's reaction to that room is the appropriate reaction to be in horror. His is just total capitalism, total how can I how can I and Googling like, can you count basement square footage and the total square footage of your house? And it was just like fucking brilliant.
Yes.
Very, very funny. And then our naked lady, big old titties. As I said.
B-O-T.
Finds him, throws him in a fucking like cage pit thing with Tess, who has now been there for presumably like maybe a couple weeks or something. And she's been there long enough to have kind of figured out how to placate this person. I was going to say creature, but it is a human. This person who has captured both of them. And basically she says she thinks of us as her babies. And we have to indulge that, basically. So this woman's like sticking the nastiest fucking rubber nipple baby bottle you've ever seen through the bars of the cage and wants them to drink from it. Tess does because she knows this is what she's got to do to keep the woman happy at this point. Justin Long is, of course, a little bitch about it. It's just nasty.
Like when you think about that's how Tess survived for 2 weeks was probably eating or drinking whatever that woman was giving her, which is horrifying. Because I'm like, how would she still be alive? And then you're like, I guess she's getting fed.
Which that's a big logistical question about this movie in general for me is how, because there's also another person in the basement who we're going to get to in a little bit. But how are these people surviving? Because I don't really have the other person in the basement is incapacitated. He's not going anywhere. The woman, I can't believe she's going to fucking Meijer with her titties hanging out to restock the house. So I'm very, I don't know. That was I guess, a plot hole.
Maybe
for
she's getting like, her groceries DoorDashed.
I'm living here. Maybe.
Or like Instacart. Just leave them on the porch.
Maybe Barbarian 2 will be about the evils of DoorDash.
There we go. More political fodder.
You know, obviously it's not explained, but who knows, like the old dude, the old fuck, he could have like highly stocked up on like baby formula like decades prior that she's still using. I doubt they had frequent guests in the tunnels.
Because we do see him in a grocery store, right? The first time that we get any backstory on him, he's in the grocery store buying baby supplies. So I guess we should let's get into that, right? So
Let's explain who he is. Yeah, there's a guy named Frank in the basement.
Yeah, there's a whole flashback scene that I had completely forgotten about.
Me too.
Which is bizarre because it's a striking scene. Like the visual style is completely different. It's set in, you know, what, the 60s probably?
Yeah.
60s or 70s.
Yeah, early 70s.
Yeah. Very well done. Like another example of, I think this is a very well directed, like well made movie. But sorry, I interrupted you. But yeah, just weird that we all forgot that.
Yeah.
Even though like it's so colorful, it pops in a way the rest of the movie doesn't. It's just, it's striking.
And it's a critical plot point.
It is because it kind of helps you understand. It helps you understand the history of the neighborhood to a degree and the history of the house. And so, yeah, you see younger Frank and he's just going about his day and you discover that he is stalking, well, in this scene, like a particular woman. But before that, he goes to the store and gets you know, all these supplies under the guise of his wife is having a baby and they're going to have a home delivery and he gets a plastic sheet. Okay, makes sense for a home delivery.
Mm-hmm. Latex gloves, you know, diapers.
Yeah. Baby formula. Oh, and that's where they get the videotape, the VHS. The woman who's helping him out hands him a VHS for breastfeeding.
Oh, right. So it's definitely way past the 60s then.
70s. It's got to be 70s.
It's got to be 70s, yeah.
Was there even VHS in the 70s?
There was, I think.
Okay.
I think that's when it first came out.
Yeah. Interesting.
Early 80s at the latest, but it looked more like 70s.
It looked like, yeah, like mid to late 70s.
But yeah, he takes all this stuff back to the house and goes down to the basement. There's a woman screaming down there. And so we find out that over, you know, probably decades, he kidnapped, held against their will, raped, and killed apparently a lot of women based on the number of videotapes that he has in the basement.
And impregnated some as well, who then had babies who then would grow up. And then he would impregnate them. And there was just severe inbreeding going on, which leads us to the character known as the mother, Big Ol' Titties.
B-O-T.
Who seems to be the last one. She's like, she's the last one apart from Frank, who she's been keeping alive, barely.
Yes.
Yeah. So the only other person down in the basement besides Justin Long's character and mother... Well, Tess was there, but she escaped. Mm-hmm. So I guess we'll get to that in a minute. But yeah, was Frank, and he's not doing great.
Nah, he's old shit.
He's old.
Yeah, because Tess starts to escape, so AJ goes wandering by himself while the mother is trying to track down Tess, and he finds Frank. Frank pulls out a gun, which we think he's going to use to shoot AJ. We're like, come on, blow this motherfucker's head off.
Just
do Frank shoots himself.
Yeah.
Because he thinks the jig is up, I guess.
Yeah, he's just like, I'm done.
Which, frankly, he's gotten away with so much at this point. I'm like, why not just kill AJ? Like, you've killed a lot of motherfucking people. You could get away with this one.
Well, just needed to scar one more person.
Yeah,
well,
perhaps.
And presumably he didn't want to be alive anymore, right? He's old. His quality of life sucks. He's stuck in this basement. He doesn't get to kill or rape anybody anymore. Like, he's done. So
all the things that make him happy, he can no longer do.
Bummer. Sorry for you. And mother, his daughter, I guess, is keeping him alive because he's her only tether to humanity. That's it. That's all she has. So it made sense to me that he would kill himself. I don't know how you had the will to live that long.
So one more little nod to sort of ancient history. And again, who knows if this was intended, because like Kreger kind of seems to have shot down the theories around the connection to the origins of the word barbarian. But a Redditor threw out a theory that I thought was interesting, which is that like this entire maze under the house is a retelling of like the Theseus and the Minotaur story. Like this is a labyrinth and the monster is at the center of it, as the Minotaur was at the center of the labyrinth. And they also pointed out a possible parallel to the golden thread that Theseus uses to navigate the labyrinth in the form of the tape measure, which is... to a certain degree, also like sort of a line that leads back through the maze to a certain degree. I thought that was interesting, whether it's intentional or not.
Huh.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that story, but Redditors are fucking smart, man.
Mythology.
Yeah, got it. I guess so Tess escapes successfully. Mm-hmm. And this is when she finally gets the police on the line. My God, if this isn't a commentary about police ineptitude and racism and classism, I don't know what is, right? The police come and they completely just dismiss her.
They just think she's like, you know, a drug addict who's been wandering the streets.
Because she's in Brightmoor, right?
And she's disheveled because she's been in a tunnel system for 3 weeks.
And she's brown.
Yep.
And one of the police officers is a black man, but like still it's the system that it's systemic to not believe certain people. And it is, as I think all of us are aware, you know, it's a very common thing in the system to not believe black women and their experiences. And so she just gets completely dismissed by them. And they laugh at her, basically, and leave her. They take her back to the house and leave her there.
Yeah.
Which is so fucked.
And at this point, her car's been outside the whole time. She hasn't had her keys because she has mm-hmm. escaped from the basement through the window, right? Again? Mm-hmm. This time she's smart enough, and another nod to Tess's good instincts, to go back in the house. She breaks into the house through the front door now and grabs her keys and takes the fuck mm-hmm. off. And she's out of the woods. Like, she can go and finish the rest of her life if she wants, but she's a fucking good person. Mm-hmm. God damn it. Because she wants to go back and rescue AJ, Justin Long's character. And up until this point, she doesn't know what a piece of shit he is. And I don't know if that yeah. even would have deterred her, because she genuinely is an empath and a good person. But it comes back around to bite her in the ass.
The cop thing, like, struck me as another positive example of the way Kreger writes this character into corners in very realistic ways. You know, I mean, so often, you know, common trope in a horror movie, why don't they call the police? Mm. Or common trope, oh, they called the police, but the phone lines are cut, or their phone battery is dead.
Or the villain kills the police as soon as they get there, yeah.
Exactly. There's a million contrivances for the police to not show up. And how often do you see a horror movie where the police just don't give a shit? Yeah. In, frankly, I think, a pretty realistic way, because, you know, Detroit police are infamous. And I'm sure this is also similar to the housing and gentrification issues, not unique to Detroit, but I mean, Detroit police are infamous for long, long response times, or just you don't get a response.
Yeah.
And it was like, yep, this is probably exactly what that looks like, especially if you're in a shitty neighborhood and you are a disheveled looking woman of color telling a story that does sound far-fetched.
Yeah, they don't have capital to protect in a neighborhood like that.
That's right.
Yeah. So why bother with it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a good moment. As far as, you know, these kind of like hot button topical sort of moments we keep talking about, that was one that hit really well for me.
Yeah. You use the word realistic, and I think that that's how I felt through this whole movie. Like, not necessarily that this could happen, but like stuff.
It's pretty bonkers.
It is bonkers. But however, it's not. There's nothing supernatural going on here. Like, in theory, mm-hmm. it could happen. But mm-hmm. more so, these things do happen on like a microaggression, everyday occurrence to people that are of, you know, disproportionate means or whatever. But yeah, that scene, ooh, that pissed me off. I was so angry for her with her.
Mm-hmm. It's smart writing.
Really smart writing. So Tess eventually gets in her car, and right as she does that, mother comes through the broken window in the basement in a very scary, like, jump scare moment. And presumably she gets out right at night, so this isn't her first time out. But this is Tess's opportunity to kill her once and for all, which, again, great instincts. Tess powers her car as fast as it'll go forward and crushes Mother between the house and her car. And I thought she was dead. Like, there was no way someone could survive that.
You see the life leave her eyes, seemingly like Janet Leigh in Psycho.
Yep, which gives AJ a chance to escape. And I think as she's dealing with AJ, they look over and realize Mother's gone. Like, she was supposed, where did she go? She was supposed to be there, like, really tropey moment of horror. Like, she was there and now she's not.
Mm-hmm.
And then they meet up with the homeless guy who we saw a little bit at the beginning of the movie. And he says,
who seemed like a scary dude at first.
Yeah, the first time
Tess was literally running to the house to get away from him just because he was a scary guy in Brightmoor.
Right, exactly. Which therein lies another little political statement that, like, I mean, he was being scary. He was approaching her at night and saying, like, hey, little girl, come here. He was trying to warn her, but, like, there's another small implication that, you know, well, he's homeless and he's a person of color, so, and he's a man. So he's, no good can come of this, which I like that they confronted that he was actually there to help them. And you were wrong to assume that he was bad. But I think then he takes them to his camp and says, hey, here's the history of Mother and the history of this house, and kind of lays out the inbreeding that's been going on, Frank's history. And but he says in this very like, oh God, here we go moment. He's like, well, we're safe here because she's never in the 16 years or the 40 years. I don't remember how long I've lived here. She's never come here.
Yeah.
Only to have her.
Because he's got barbed wire. He's like living in an old water tower. He's got a little section of fence that he rolls up to get in there. It seems mm-hmm. to be a very, you know, as well fortified as anything in this area can be, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Only to have mother
course, it's
pop
hot.
Up and smash his head yeah, in.
Right after he says she's never been here. This is like the only safe area in the neighborhood.
She just smashes through a wall like the fucking Hulk.
Yeah,
like the Kool-Aid literally. Man.
Yeah.
Smashes his head in, which is her favorite way of killing people, apparently.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they go up the water tower to try and get away from her. And Justin Long, being Justin Long, throws Tess off the water tower so that Mother will, like, go after her
go
baby.
Get her baby.
Like, uses her
leave
as
him
a,
alone.
Yeah, uses her as, like, bait.
Mm-hmm. And this was great when he like talks himself into how he's doing the right thing, like out loud. He's like, yeah, and it's clear that he's also talking about like making amends mm-hmm. for the rape, but also like he has no idea of what making amends actually looks like. And so it's just more of his douchebaggery. It's like perfectly written and perfectly performed because Justin Long plays it like this guy is 100% sincere and thinks that he's being a good guy in this moment. And there's no like wink and a nod to the screen that this guy is evil. But if you're like a person with a brain, you know he's evil and he's doing yet another evil thing. It's that was a wonderful moment to me.
Yeah, we missed one part to discuss where the three of them are sitting at the homeless encampment and Justin Long seems to have a moment of total clarity where he's being self-aware for the first time in his life, we think. I mean, presumably.
Oh, right. That's where that happens.
Yeah.
I guess it's not on the water tower. Yeah, that's right.
And he's like sort of atoning out loud. He's owning up to what he's done without specifically laying out the details. He's like, I think I might be a bad person. And they don't really know what he's talking about, but they're kind of like, you know, like, proverbially like patting him on the back like you're okay man, and then he fucking pushes her off the water tower to use her as bait. Like instantly you're just like, no, you are a scumbag still through and through.
And then she survives the fall because the mother basically breaks her fall. And
okay,
and
so that was confusing to me because she falls first. How does she wind up on
I don't
top
know.
Of the mother.
I don't know.
Because he said, because he pushed Tess off and he said, go get your baby to mother. And so she jumped after her. She jumped out off the water tower to go and save Tess or get Tess. And she landed on top of her. It doesn't totally make sense why Tess survived, but she did.
Yeah, that was confusing
to me. I had to rewind that scene a couple of times.
It doesn't explain it.
I rewound that scene a couple of times to rewatch it. But Justin Long was essentially saying, not like I'm going to give myself time to get away from mother. Like I'm going to use Tess because she's the only thing that this mother cares about right now because she thinks she's her baby to get rid of them both. Which he thinks he does. Yeah. And lo and behold, neither of them are dead.
Right. Yeah, no. Neither of them
somehow
are dead.
Somehow they both survived to fall from a water tower.
And then it's so funny, like him apologizing to Tess when he realizes she's still alive. He's like, I wasn't thinking. And I thought that was like the best way to, like, you know, save us. And
just total so, oh trash God. Person.
And this is when Mother arises from the apparent grave for the second time and like I basically rips Justin Long in half, right? Like she grabs him by the eyeballs and just like I think literally just rips his head in half.
Yeah, I didn't watch it this time because I didn't.
Yeah.
The first time was enough. Oh,
you missed some good eyeball jelly. Yeah.
It was a good for her moment. She was the lesser of two evils, in my opinion.
Yeah. Like he... Yeah.
Like, what was his excuse? This woman hasn't ever been civilized. He's got everything, and he's just chooses to be an asshole.
Yeah.
Mother truly did not know any better. And then Tess and Mother have a great acting moment for both of them, but Tess is just like, I'm not going back. Because Mother's instinct is, oh, baby, like, I'm going to go take care of mm-hmm. you. She's nonverbal, but I mean, that's the idea.
But she could say, baba, like, yeah. She can make sounds like baby.
Which is what I was going to mention before about the barbarian thing. Like, that's the other, like, element of the barbar theory is that the only thing mother says is baba, which is a nod to that. So, you know, whatever.
To the great.
Make of
the
that what you will. Yeah. Yeah. But Tess is just like, nah, I ain't doing this, fam. And she shoots Mother in the head.
She shoots her with Frank's gun, poetically.
With Frank's gun, yes.
And that was actually like a weirdly touching moment to me. Because Tess had empathy for her.
Yeah.
Like, and it felt like Tess was like, I need to put you out of your misery.
Yeah, yeah, and she knew Mother wasn't going to stop.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Like, it was for herself, obviously, but also, you know, being like... to me, it really read as she was like, I need to put this woman out of her suffering. Like, she has no quality of life. And
yeah, it's an emotionally nuanced moment, and they both play it well.
Yeah.
And then cut to credits and the song Be My Baby, which I don't know. Why not? It's such an awkward. I don't know, because it's funny. It's like a joke, you know? After this, like, very, like, immediately, there's no fade out, no anything. It's just hard cut from Tess shooting Mother.
Tess does, like, a walk away.
That's over the credits after Be My Baby is started.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, because they intersperse shots of her, you know, limping down the street and out into the sunset or sunrise, whatever. While Be My Baby is already playing, like, it goes right from the kill shot to Be My Baby, which struck me very oddly both times.
Well,
I don't know. I thought it was great for a movie that balanced kind of heavy stuff and levity pretty well.
Yeah, I agree. I really liked that Tess was just through and through a good person and an empathetic person. And I don't know. I think at the end of the film, I was sort of like, I would like to think that I would have made some, if not most, of the same choices that Tess made. She was far more empathetic than I could be, but she was really well-rounded, I thought. I don't know. She was one of my favorite heroines, I think, that I've seen in a horror film in a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Strong, well-written protagonist, for sure.
Yep. Well, anything else we want to cover before we wrap up The Barbarian?
Well, I mean, I think we have to have the obligatory philosophical discussion. Who was the barbarian?
AJ.
Capitalism?
Not Frank. Capitalism. Yeah, I mean, the obvious answer is everybody's a barbarian.
AJ and Frank. Capitalism. Yeah, AJ and Frank were tied for me.
Yeah. The police, Mother.
I could
apply it to almost anybody in the movie, except for Tess, I suppose.
Yeah, Mother, I wouldn't, I mean, I guess in the sense that she was, quote, uncivilized, obviously fits that description, but certainly not the greatest villain.
And also a barbarian in a different sense, because she is a resident of Barbary Street. Right. So.
Whoa.
Whoa, I know, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I loved it. I loved it.
Your head just blew open like AJ's.
Oh,
not like that.
Oh, there's too much head trauma in this movie for me.
Yeah, there is, for sure.
I mean, I enjoyed the head trauma as a gore hound, but yeah, there is a lot of it.
Well, I guess that about wraps it up for this episode, Barbarian. What is next week's episode?
Next week is Horror Catch-Up, our monthly Horror Catch-Up episode, where we will all be bringing to the table the movies, books, maybe podcasts, comics. All the different media comics that are horror-related that we've all been watching.
And I might have a report on Para, Bettina, Pengakut, Iblis, Part 2, if y'all listen to that deranged last episode.
I've got a lot of good stuff for Horror Catch-Up. I've been putting in work.
All right.
Yeah, I spent
looking forward to it.
Yeah, I spent the 4th of July watching 2 horror movies and ordering takeout and just eating and doing nothing in protest.
Amazing.
That sounds ideal.
Wearing all black.
Amazing. The ideal Independence Day celebration.
For this year, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that about does it for us here on Every Horror Movie on Netflix. Until next time, I am one of your hosts, Allison with an I.
I'm Allison with a Y.
And I'm Patrick.
See you next time.